This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Well, the tab for disaster recovery has reached new heights following a wild year, which saw the loss of some 700 homes to the volcano and damage to infrastructure across the state. HPR's Kuvehi Irishi spent some time on the Big Island, and she has more on the recovery effort. Morning.
Good morning, Catherine. That's right. So we've been continuing to hear from folks who have had their experience with FEMA and aid. And one interesting story and very uniquely Puna set up was this eco-village. So this a group of about two dozen individuals who decided to kind of go in it together and purchase land together. So they have about 105 acres and they all have 5 acres each. But the way that it was set up was set up like a limited liability corporation. And so when they went in for FEMA aid, FEMA had said, no, you're a business technically. We can't help you. So this is a very unique situation, but interesting because some folks received rental assistance. And this one individual that we spoke to, Mariana Toronto, she actually got the max check for her home, which she did lose on account of the lava. So she got the $34,000 check. And this is sort of her reaction to what happened next.
They cut me a check, and 2 weeks later, you know, I went in, I told them what the situation was, that nobody else was getting funding. And so then they realized it was a mistake, and so they took it right back. And unfortunately, they're sending letters to people who received rental assistance from our HUI, telling us that we shouldn't even have received the rental assistance. And so I think FEMA has asked several of them to, you know, pay it back.
So that recoupment process, she was lucky she didn't try to spend that money immediately. You know, she knew. she wasn't sure what the rest of her HUI members were receiving, if they were getting checks, but she was the only one to get that initial check. And in speaking to FEMA, you know, they said this is normal. There are instances where they try to encourage folks to just sign up for the aid, no matter what. If you can't get to your home, just try it anyway, just so you have some money until you have access to your home. So we do know there are folks who have been cut off from, you know, getting to their home to see if it actually was damaged. So in those instances, FEMA will contact them later saying, okay, no, your home is still up. You need to pay that back. But in looking at the number of applicants or applications that FEMA took in, so they got about almost 3,000 applications, and only about a third of that was actually approved. So two-thirds were denied. It was interesting. So about $11.7 million was dished out by FEMA specifically for individual and household assistance, right? So these are folks looking for rental assistance or looking to get the max on the worth of their home so they can relocate, and that's that $34,000. So in speaking to Michael Kern, he's the voluntary agency liaison for that individual assistance division with FEMA. He says there are a number of reasons why these applications are denied.
One of the most common reasons why an applicant would be ineligible for FEMA individual assistance is when the inspector gets there and looks at the home, they would determine that it's insufficient damage to the property. Maybe some of the damage or misrepair you see is from, you know, deferred maintenance or non-disaster related causes. And sometimes folks have a hard time, again, just with the documentation to prove that they actually lived at that residence at the time of the disaster. And that's to prevent, again, you know, fraud and other things.
So that documentation was interesting because in instances in Puna, we know a lot of folks do not pay for water. They don't have utility bills for certain things because they live off the grid. So it's not having that sort of documentation, which is already part of the living routine out there, that was making it hard for some folks to actually receive assistance. FEMA has said that this year they were quick to dish out that individual assistance, but that the reimbursements to county, which right now are estimated to be about $154 million, that was a little slower. So they've only dished out about $9.7 million, meaning FEMA has already reimbursed the county for about $9.7 million, but they do anticipate $154. And this is something that FEMA and HAIMA are both seeing, these increases in cost on account of the increases in disaster activity that they're seeing. So Tom Travis, head of HAIMA here, has said that the cost, the single cost of last year's disasters for Haima will be more than what they've dished out since 1992. So 26 years worth of disaster aid in 1 year is essentially what they're saying. Yeah, and FEMA seeing the same thing. So this is Bob Troy, the Federal Disaster Recovery Coordinator for FEMA's Region 9, talking about that increase in activity.
Yeah, there are currently projections that FEMA will spend more money on disaster activity in the past 2 years than in the previous 38 years combined. And whether it plays out exactly along those lines or not, if that turns out to be totally accurate, the increase in disaster activity and the costs associated with it are significant.
FEMA, he was saying that, you know, these things take time. I guess last year, FEMA just closed out their repair and recovery work for the 1994 Northridge earthquake in California, and that they're still working on Sandy recovery with New York and in Louisiana with storms. So they don't anticipate to be leaving in terms of recovery work for the Big Island for a lot of years to come.
Right. And I know when we had talked to Tom Travis of Haima that he had said that they were going to put in for money in the budget because they needed support staff to help process a lot of these requests that were coming in.
Exactly. So increased need for staffing, but also just for looking, I guess, managing this long-term recovery, because it is going to take time, right, to make sure everyone gets their ducks in order. But we've got about $1.7 million grant recently the County of Hawaii received to sort of look at the long-term disaster case management. So this will be essentially for folks who have not yet received aid or who haven't been able to receive aid under certain circumstances, like the folks in this Eco Village or LLC in Puna. This money will help fund case managers that can help connect them with those resources and try to figure out their individual circumstances.
I see.
Forward.
So they might still be eligible for some help, just not FEMA's.
Right. Under the Small Business Administration loans or just other venues, but the case managers that will be coming on. And it's up to the county to figure out how they want to use this $1.7 million. But that will be used for sort of making sure those folks that have not yet received assistance have that support.
Did you talk to anybody about any of the money that the state lawmakers
approved? Yeah. The county was, of course, very happy with the money that they're getting, because a lot of it goes to reimburse them for expenses that they have already sort of used. But in terms of individuals, I think for the folks who haven't received any aid, they're just frustrated with the process and not necessarily blaming anyone in particular. But I think as more of this money and sort of looking at folks who haven't received aid, I think as that goes on, that you'll probably see more happy faces.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much. That was HPR's Kuuwehi Hiraishi. You can read her reports online at hawaiipublicradio.org. We are sticking with Hawaii Island for our next story. The island took an economic hit following last year's natural disasters, and the recovery has been a slow one. Miles Yoshioka is the executive officer of the Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce. In a recent op-ed, he made the case for increasing the Big Island's economic resilience by expanding the astronomy industry. HPR's Ryan Finnerty has more.
Man, our island did take a hit. You know, of course, not only with the eruption, but the storms that had hit our island really took its toll. Over 700 homes were either destroyed or affected by the flow. All those homes were located within the area close to Pahoa Town. So a lot of the businesses in Pahoa were deeply affected. you know, you had two major communities, the Leilani subdivision and the Kapoho area, which really supported this town and the visitor industry that came along with it. So Pahoa really took a hit. It really didn't help our island with how the national news portrayed what was actually happening here. According to the national news, it seemed like the entire island, and I think sometimes even the entire state was under siege by this volcano. But, you know, it really just affected a small portion of the island. And that area was hit hard, but the entire island, and including our visitor industry, was deeply affected.
When you say deeply affected, do we have any kind of numbers in terms of what sort of decline we saw in the visitor industry?
For that particular area, the Puna area, there's a lot of agriculture that was affected. So we had orchid farms, papaya farms, decorative foliage farms. The reported losses in the agriculture sector were over $28 million total. Huge amount of inventory loss. The figures for crops was over $17 million of that $28 million total.
Well, Miles, all that gets to the potential pitfalls of being too reliant on one particular industry. In this case, for Hawaii Island, it maybe was the visitor industry. And then we see what happens when there is any kind of event that hurts that industry. You're proposing diversification focusing on astronomy.
Correct. That's correct. Well, astronomy is one major sector that our chamber has been supporting for, gosh, over 50 years.
In a recent editorial, you wrote about a time previously when astronomy was used to kind of pick Hilo up after a previous natural disaster. And I wonder if you could just explain that a little bit.
Yeah, just after the 1960 tsunami that hit Hilo, Mitsuo Akiyama, who was our chamber executive secretary at the time, saw the devastation and saw how the East Hawaii economy was hit. So he took upon himself to think about and explore several ways of building our local economy. Just through talking story, he spoke with Howard Ellis, who was an astrophysicist up on Mauna Loa at the time, who commented, you know, how clear the air was up on the mountains. They kept this discussion going, and a couple years later, thanks to help from our state legislature and then Governor Burns, were able to get funding to build a roadway from Halepohaku to the summit of Mauna Kea. Eventually, the first telescope was put on the mountain. It belonged to the University of Hawaii. This small step led to a multi-billion dollar industry that is not only helping our island, our country, and really the world. We've come a long way.
For astronomy to really become a viable alternative to tourism, or at least to diversify the economy further, it needs to expand. And there has been no small amount of opposition to expanding astronomy on Mauna Kea and expanding telescope construction, the TMT being the most obvious example. Do you really think there is an appetite in the community on Hawaii Island for such an expansion?
I definitely believe there is. You know, last polls that I've heard shows that 70% of the people on the island are in favor of the 30-meter telescope. Astronomy is a clean industry. You know, the technology in itself with observatories on the mountain have come a long way. You know, we're not talking facilities that were put up, you know, 50, 40, 30 years ago. They've cleaned up everything, or they've cleaned up, you know, the facilities up there. It is going to be a clean industry. Granted, there is opposition, but we do feel it is a minority, and we hope, you know, clear heads will prevail and realize that this is something that will help our children, or, you know, the next generations, and build up an economy where we can have higher paying jobs for our island.
You mentioned in your piece 1,400 jobs statewide in astronomy. More than half of those are on Hawaii Island, and economic impacts to your island of about $90 million a year. Statewide, it's $170 million for astronomy. Statewide, the tourism industry in Hawaii is worth $16 billion with a B. So is it feasible for astronomy to really be a significant diversifier with such a gigantic tourism industry?
I think it can. You know, the jobs that astronomy brings to our island and state, we're just not talking astronomers. We're not just talking scientists. It's support crews, construction, down to clerical. You know, if you think about it, up on the mountain, many of the telescopes are being remotely operated. So there's staff down in Hilo, in Waimea, that are needed to support the telescopes. You know, we do have a lot of students, a lot of kids studying here, as well as moving away to the mainland to study. But we need to provide a chance for them to come home and offer the types of jobs that they're looking for.
What do you think the astronomy industry and people in that industry who want to work in Hawaii need to do to address the types of concerns that were raised about the 30-meter telescope and caused so much of the disagreement that we saw?
Okay, well, I think a lot of the concerns raised were addressed, dealing with groundwater or waste treatment systems. You know, our astronomers have taken big steps to become active members of our community. I have personal friends who work in the astronomy industry, and a lot of them are from here already. You know, they're residents. Some of them come from away, but they are contributing members of our community. And I think we need to keep that in mind, that everyone is, you know, trying to work together on this, and we hope everyone can be a part of it.
All right, Miles Yoshioka, thanks for your time today.
Okay, thank you, Ryan.
You've been hearing from Miles Yoshioka, Executive Officer of the Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce. We'll have a link to his recent editorial in the Hawaii Tribune Herald posted on hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Eric Soberger from Hawaii International Music Festival. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
I'm Willem Blease. I'm a piano tuner technician living on Oahu. I also fly over to Molokai and I fly to Kauai quite frequently to tune pianos over there. I heard one of my customers, actually, who was a piano teacher, was underwriting something on HPR. So then I got in touch with the station. I said, okay, I want to do this too. I think it's very important that businesses and individuals support the station.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
Hey, brother. How's it? Pigeon remains one of the strongest and most distinctive elements of culture in Hawaii. But what about its future? A panel of experts will weigh in on the question, will pigeons survive the 21st century? In a public forum moderated by me, Noe Tanigawa, presented by Zocalo Public Square and the Daniel K.E. Noe Institute. Tonight at Artistry Honolulu in Kaka'ako. Free admission. Reservations at hprtickets.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide members-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua. wa oni hau uka wa oa umulokai ulana umau uka holabe o hawai.
Mauna Ala, or Fragrant Mountain, is the final resting place for most of Hawaii's kings and queens. Situated on 3 elegant acres near Oahu Cemetery in Lower Nuuanu, the royal mausoleum was not originally intended as such. Rather, it was built solely for Crown Prince Albert, the only child of Queen Emma and King Kamehameha IV. 4-year-old Albert's tragic death in August of 1862 was followed in November of 1863 by the passing of his grieving father. And soon after, the spacious mausoleum site was expanded to receive the monarchs interred at the more crowded Pohukainu Mausoleum on Iolani Palace grounds. In October of 1865, a solemn procession brought the ali'i from Pohukaina for reinterment at Mauna Ala, now the resting place, the final resting place for kings and queens of both the Kamehameha and the Kalakaua dynasties. All but three, that is, two kings and a queen. Now, for today's question, can you identify these royal members and where are they interred? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Advanced Psychiatric Therapeutics on Oahu, working with patients one at a time to help break the opioid addiction cycle using current treatments such as Suboxone. More at hawaiipsych.com.
Decisions around immigration made from the White House stand to have a ripple effect here in the islands. That's the subject of today's reality check. Honolulu Civil Beat reporter Anita Hofschneider on the line this morning. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your story focuses on public housing.
Yes. I'm looking into a proposed rule by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development that aims to block undocumented immigrants from receiving public housing assistance or Section 8 assistance.
So this is something that just kicked in?
So it's just a proposal. It hasn't yet gone into effect, but it has been newly proposed, and now it will be open for public comment for 60 days.
Okay. Now, so that was just published in the Register then?
Yes.
And so what happens now? What could the effect be here in Hawaii?
Sure. So the way it works now is that it's okay for recipients of Section 8 vouchers or public housing tenants to be undocumented as long as they're part of a family that includes a U.S. citizen or legal immigrant. For example, a family might have a U.S. citizen children, but the parents came here illegally. And so I called around to the Hawaii Public Housing Authority and the various counties that administer Section 8 vouchers, and I found that at least a dozen Hawaii families could become homeless under the proposal. And I wasn't able to get the numbers from Maui, but from the Public Housing Authority, there are 4 families that would be affected by this. And from calling the other counties, there are about 8 families that would no longer be eligible for Section 8 vouchers under this. So as you can see, that's not a very high number, but local attorneys told me that the impact could actually be much broader than that.
It's interesting, though, that they don't have any kind of, a priority list, right, when it comes to public housing.
Well, and when it comes to public housing, a lot of the priority goes to people who have been previously homeless. And so that's part of the concern here, is that for people who are homeless, you may not have kept all of your documents, all of your identification documents when you were moving from place to place. And so that's a concern that I'm hearing from local attorneys who work with low-income people. They're saying that it might be common for legal residents or even U.S. citizens to have lost their papers that they need to prove that they are eligible for housing. So even though it seems like just a few families could be affected by this, there could be ripple effects.
Well, I know that there is a huge waiting list, though, for our public housing, isn't there, around the state?
Yes. We only have about 6,100 public housing units through the State Public Housing Authority, and there are nearly 14,000 people waiting for housing.
Wow.
So that's part of the reason for this proposal, is they're saying that these resources should be going to people who are here legally.
Yes, I was looking at some of the comments that people were making online saying that the people here should be given first priority, you know, on the list. So there's some rub there.
Yes, there's definitely, you know, as you know, immigration is such a controversial topic. There are people who have really strong feelings, you know, in both directions. But what is interesting is looking at what the impact could be on U.S. citizens. For example, nationally, HUD has said that about 55,000 U.S. citizen children could be affected by this. They could lose their housing because their parents are here illegally, or you know, and they're even though they were born in the U.S., they could actually be evicted under this proposal.
Right, and that's a concern because you want to have a stable living situation for the keiki.
Exactly, and as you know, there's such a housing crisis here. Even spending years and years and years on the wait list in Oahu, the wait list for public housing is 17 years long, and so you could be waiting, you know, over a dozen years to get access to this, and to lose it because you don't have the right papers is something that you know, advocates for low-income people are really concerned about.
Right, and we've just had this recent controversy about how a number of Pacific Islanders, some migrants, are having some difficulty in getting driver's licenses, and that's kind of compounded things too.
Exactly. So one of the concerns is how are they going to define you being here legally? So, you know, I know what you're referring to is a new guidance from the Department of Homeland Security that said that if you are here from one of the three COFA nations, the Marshall Islands, Palau, or the Federated States of Micronesia, you should prove your citizenship prove your legality in order through having a visa or an employment authorization document if you want to get a federally approved driver's license or state ID. But unfortunately, you know, people, that doesn't work for most people because they don't have those either document because they can come here legally without those documents. And so it's caused a lot of confusion in the community. And so one of the concerns is how are they going to define legal immigrants for this, you know, for the purposes of this housing rule? If they define it similarly in terms of having a visa, then you're excluding a lot of people who are actually here legally.
And for folks who are undocumented, I'm sure that this proposed rule is going to be cause for more concern, and you know, they might be scared about, I guess, getting caught, so to speak.
Yes, and that's another concern that one attorney brought up to me. She was saying that people might be self-policing. They might not apply for housing that they're actually legally entitled to and that could really help them further their situation and provide stability to their children because of that fear. And so she was saying that's just as effective as, you know, actually implementing the rule, and it's, you know, something that is a major concern.
Okay, and so the comment period then ends... When?
It ends in July, yes.
Okay, so people need to put their 2 cents in if they're concerned about this.
Yes,
thank you
very much.
Okay, thank you. That was reporter Anita Hofschneier with today's Reality Check. To read her full story and more, visit civilbeat.org. Just Mauka of Nu'uanu Memorial Park on Nu'uanu Avenue, look to your right and you'll see Mauna Ala, the royal mausoleum. It's the final resting place for most of Hawaii's kings and queens. And this is just one of three places in the islands where the Kingdom of Hawaii's flag flies proudly alone. Originally built to house the remains of Prince Albert and then his father, King Kamehameha IV, the mausoleum was enlarged to receive the remains of both Kamehameha and Kalakaua dynasty royalty. Then in turn at the more crowded Pohukaina mausoleum on Iolani Palace grounds. Now, solemn reinterment rites were held October 30th, 1865, following the casket procession from the palace. And earlier we told you that two kings and one queen are not buried at Mauna Ala, and we asked you who and where they are. Well, first, Kamehameha the Great, buried somewhere in secret on Hawaii Island. And his highest-ranking queen, Keopuolani, Pualani. She converted to Christianity and is interred at Waiola Church on Maui. And finally, King Lunalilo. His tomb is at the Kauai Hau Church. And that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Governor David Ige has until next month to let lawmakers know what bills may be on his veto list. His staff is currently reviewing other bills for him to sign or for passage without his signature. He sat down with us yesterday afternoon to talk about some high points and low points, including the challenges of keeping his cabinet together for his final term. On Friday, the deputy director of the Agriculture Department, Glenn Muranaka, stepped down after just being approved by the Senate.
Well, I mean, I think that we continue to make progress in the most important areas. They agreed and funded many of our requests for homelessness, again, focusing on housing first and making sure that, you know, when we can place homeless individuals in permanent housing, we do find that we are more successful in reducing the number of homeless all across the state. And for the third year in a row, the number of homeless in the point in time count is actually down again. So for three consecutive years, for the first time that I can remember in a very, very long time, we actually have fewer homeless here in the state. And, you know, we continue to work through that. As you know, the lieutenant governor has been very active in especially the chronically homeless, those who are mentally ill or with substance abuse challenges. And, you know, there were so the legislature agreed for our budget request on homelessness. As part of that, the lieutenant governor was asking for making it a little bit easier to administer medication for mentally ill individuals, so that we can get to a point of helping them.
You've got a deadline out there looming as far as bills that you might veto. One of the big ones, I think, is the vacation rental issue.
I haven't had a chance to review the final legislation, but I do hear it more and more in our community that they're concerned about vacation rentals. It has permeated virtually every community across the state, and you know, we need to do a better job of collecting taxes owed, as well as helping counties to regulate vacation rentals. And so, you know, I'll be looking at the measure with that lens and trying to make sure that we can do a better job of collecting taxes and then making sure that they comply with county regulations.
The numbers as far as what could be collected, it's enticing because, you know, we could certainly use that money to fund programs like homelessness.
Certainly, but I think the concern that I have is the unintended consequences. You know, we do see an explosion of vacation rentals, and it impacts us in two different ways. On one, in as much as I'd like to see the continued increase in the number of visitors here, because the number of hotel properties have been pretty flat, most of the growth is really coming from short-term vacation rentals. And I hear it from the community more and more. They're concerned about getting too many tourists here. And so I definitely want to make sure that we're not facilitating illegal activity. You know, and we know that we need to do a better job of investing in the infrastructure so that the vacation rentals don't have so much of an impact on the local community. That is very, very important, especially, and we've seen the dramatic difference. And I know that we had flooding in Hanalei, which has reduced the number of visitors who could visit Hanalei. And as you know, we've reissued a new master plan for Haena State Park that we're trying to reduce the number of visitors that go up to that North Shore area. But so we need to manage and be aware that vacation rentals do bring more visitors here and that they are beginning to have an impact in our community. The second part of that is vacation rentals do have higher economic value, and we are taking homes and apartments out of the rental market for local residents and, you know, converting them into vacation rentals. And that exacerbates our housing shortage.
Right. The housing and homelessness situation, really all related. If we could go back to homelessness, I know that there's just this rub between the state and the city and the enforcement of the rules, particularly in Kaka'ako.
Actually, we've been working together. As you know, Mayor Caldwell and I have been working, and we've made arrangements to transfer the parks in Kaka'ako to the city so that they can more seamlessly enforce in the parks in that community. And so we've been working on a couple other things. We have a pilot program for law enforcement assisted diversion. So it's sort of like drug court, except it's where police officers, and we're focused in Chinatown, would have the ability to take a homeless individual who is alleged to have committed a property crime and offer them to move into a homeless shelter rather than moving into jail. So we are working with the Honolulu Police Department. We believe that it can be effective in moving those who are chronically homeless, especially, and encourage them to move into a shelter or
yeah, get off the street.
Right, get off the street. I think the challenge is, and you see it, especially in Kaka'ako Park, that there are different rules that apply to sidewalks. And so we have to give those who are on sidewalks 24 hours notice, you know, that they are not allowed to be there. And then, you know, we have to, if it's a public park, they're entitled to be in the public park. But once the park closes, then they have to vacate the park premises. And so, you know, there are still a couple of gaps in our ability to enforce, or the county's ability to enforce in Kaka'ako. It's amazing how homeless individuals find every single loophole that they can to find a place for them to be able to stay. And so we continue to work with the county to make sure that we can do a better job of keeping public spaces public.
The issues with the Maui prison,
mm-hmm.
What's the latest?
Well, I mean, I think we have recognized that all of our jails all across the state are overcrowded and antiquated. And, you know, we've made appropriation. It's been a priority of mine going back 4 sessions to expand capacity in all of the jails all across the state. And so, you know, clearly Maui Community Correctional Center is another facility that is overcrowded. If you've gone to the facility, and I actually visited the facility to see how much space for individuals, because the census is so high, 4 individuals share a cell space that is 96 square feet. And that is just too many people in a too limited space. But that's what we have to do. Because of the numbers that have been ordered to the jail by pretrial detainees or those with sentences for a year or less.
Well, do we have room? I mean, can we bring some of those folks over there from Maui here to Honolulu to take the pressure off?
I mean, I think the challenge is that all of the facilities are over capacity, or at least
they're tapped out.
Right, they all are. And the one facility that we still have space is the Federal Detention Center. And, you know, the Federal Detention Center has limitations on those that we can place in that facility. You know, and the challenge is, if we remove them from Maui, then, you know, in terms of people wanting to visit or other kinds of access that that they are entitled to, it would become a lot more difficult.
And as far as the guards?
We are trying to fill all of the vacancies that we have in a public safety department. The overcrowding doesn't help at all. We continue to advertise and recruit and then train ACOs. I was able to visit and talk with some of the employees there. I thank them for their public service. It is amazing what they do with the limitations that they have. A very, very antiquated facility. physical limitations on the facility itself, but they do a great job in managing all of those, the number that are ordered to that facility in the space that they have.
And the lawmakers have, I think, passed bills to deal with the emergency costs to try and repair the facility as quickly as they can.
Right, and it was tremendous when I visited the facility, how much of the repair work had been completed, you know, replacement of broken windows and cleaning up the modules that were most impacted. There's still a lot of work to do, and we have contracted for and are waiting locks and a new electronic locking system. We've ordered new doors. We have toilet facilities and sink facilities that are ordered and awaiting so that we can install them. You know, there's still too many people. I mean, it's more than that a facility was designed for. There was an effort, and they did pass some bail reform that, you know, we would like to see less people assigned to the jail facilities, because that would help us on every island all across the state.
Okay, but you haven't quite finished your review yet, so
no,
you can't tell
haven't.
Us
yes.
Okay. If you're going to sign that or not. One other thing that came up during session, a couple of your cabinet members did not get re-upped. Joby over at the Department of Hawaiian Homelands, I understand that she's been hired as a special assistant to William Ayala. You also had Ford Fujikami step down, mm-hmm. and he's over at in a civil service position over at the airport. And then also Rod Becker over
yes.
at, he was a comptroller, also working for budget and finance in a I think a civil service position as well.
Right. You know, I mean, I think that it's terrific that we have talented individuals who are really committed to public service. You know, and clearly being a director is a very tough job, you know, and it's not unusual that we have civil service employees that actually get paid more than our directors. And so, you know, I mean, I think it's a balance. They continue to want to be a public servant and make a difference every day. And so, you know, we're trying to find a position that they can best serve the public. And I'm glad that we have talented individuals who can meet the civil service requirements and continue to provide support for our communities.
Do you think some might think that doesn't reflect well, though, on your administration, that you can't keep those people in those positions?
I mean, you know, you can look at it in a wide variety of ways, Catherine. I did advocate with the Salary Commission. You know, we're the fourth highest public payer for state government. You know, the university pays higher, so the budget director at the university gets paid more than my budget director, even though their budget is under ours. The judiciary pays more, the Department of Education pays higher than the cabinet positions, and certainly I was advocating with the Salary Commission that that makes it tough to staff. You know, we've lost some deputies to civil service positions because, you know, it's hard to fault people to want to get paid more for what they do. And so, you know, we continue to look at getting the best people into the director's positions. I'm fortunate that we've been able to assemble, again, a very, very qualified candidate. Many people would be able to make more in the private sector, but they choose to be public servants.
I also just heard that the deputy director of the Agriculture Department stepped down on Friday. Folks are wondering, well, what's going on? You know, you've had two of your cabinet members not make it through the confirmation process, you know, Joby and Rod. But, you know, here's another situation where Glenn was able to get in and get the support of the Senate, but then he stepped down.
Yeah, certainly. I think it's a challenge. You know, it does take a different kind of leader who wants to be a public servant. The demands are very challenging in a lot of different ways. Coming from private sector, many have to balance the differences about working for state government. You know, it does take longer to fill vacancies, to staff positions, to get programs started. And, you know, certainly want to thank Mr. Muranaka for agreeing to serve as deputy. And I personally wish him well. And, you know, we're committed to putting together a leadership team. Yeah, I'm committed to doubling local food production, and we've made significant progress we will see in the next 12 to 18 months significant investment in agriculture here in the state of Hawaii, and you will see a significant increase in local food production. You know, and I'm confident that Phyllis will do a good job as director, and you know, we are looking for a deputy.
And, any idea on a time frame for a chief of staff?
No, certainly, except that we're trying to fill it as quickly as we can.
Just wondering, Governor, how are you looking at the big trial next week, the Kealoha trial?
You know, I'm glad that the trial is starting, and certainly I think all of us in our community are appreciative of those who choose to serve the community as law enforcement officers. Obviously, we have a higher standard for positions of leadership like chief of police, and I do think that our community wants to see what the outcome of this trial is. You know, in the meantime, we continue to have to serve the public. As you are aware, because of the federal investigation, Attorney General Claire Connors had requested and prosecuting attorney Keith Kaneshiro did step down while he was being investigated. I really do think that that's the appropriate thing to do. You know, we are committed to improving the public's perception of law enforcement. I still believe, and as I talk with people all across the state, that we have good law enforcement here in the islands. Yes, I look forward to what happens with these trials, because I think our community deserves to find out what happened. And clearly, if there was wrongful activities that that a jury finds, that appropriate action would be taken.
Right, we need to restore the trust, the public
Absolutely.
Trust in these positions. Anything else you'd like to underscore, Governor, just about the session? And
no, I'm looking forward to the second term. You know, I'm happy to see that the priorities continue. You know, I feel very good about where we are with affordable housing. I see in Kaka'ako that it's been different. As you know, we've dedicated a number of affordable projects in that area. All of the pieces that are necessary for affordable rentals are in place, and we are completing and moving affordable rentals out to meet my goal of 10,000 new units by 2020. And I think we are seeing the legislature embrace the whole notion of 99-year leases, so that it would allow us to have for sale affordable condominiums. I think that that will be an important part of our commitment to building more houses for our members in our community.
I know the number of lawmakers are going to be heading to Singapore to go look-see at that model.
Yes, and there will be some from the administration. I know that Craig Hirai, executive director at Hawaii Housing Finance and Development Corporation, will be part of that delegation. You know, we definitely want to have a better understanding of how it works in Singapore, and looking to bring the best practices home to Hawaii so we can create more homes for our community.
All right. Well, thank you, Governor.
Thank you.
That was Governor David Ige talking about pressing community issues, some of the bills waiting for his review, and the challenges of keeping a leadership team together as he moves into his final term in office.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bishop Museum. The exhibition Kini Kekua, Transformative Images, explores how the relationships between images and people can change over time, now through September 2nd, bishopmuseum.org.
Well, that wraps it up for today. Up tomorrow, we'll give you another opportunity to talk with conservation experts about how best to take care of your family treasures. If you have something on your mind, call our talkback line, record a message for us. That number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation HPR and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them on the conversation page on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of the conversation.